history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories all around you just waiting to be told, and we have the privilege of hearing some of those stories here each time. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Over the years, we've been privileged to hear from quite a few Pearl Harbor survivors, people who were there on the island of Oahu on December 7th, 1941, who saw that surprise attack unfold from so many different perspectives on that fateful Sunday morning. Nobody knows for sure, but it's estimated that nationwide, a little more than 1,000 Pearl Harbor survivors remain alive today. And occasionally, we hear about them on the news. Just this week, all the local TV stations were out in Tulsa, Oklahoma to celebrate Lonnie Cook, one of the last five men alive who was on the USS Arizona during that attack. He just moved to the Sacramento area, and the people of Tulsa gave Lonnie and his wife Marietta a special send-off with the help of a nonprofit called A Soldier's Wish. Another one of those Arizona survivors, Don Stratton, who you've heard from on this program, was honored last month in Colorado Springs, where a bridge on Interstate 25 was named in his honor. Colorado Springs is still mourning the death of Jim Downing earlier this year at the age of 104. Jim's book, The Other Side of Infamy, is one of the most uplifting Pearl Harbor books I've read. But the focus of today's program is going to be another man who just completed his journey here on Earth. Of all the Pearl Harbor survivors I've been privileged to spend a little time with, there's nobody I was blessed to form a deeper connection with than Chuck Lishman and his wonderful wife, Dorothy. Theirs was the only 75th wedding anniversary party I've ever been invited to, and they marked their 77th anniversary just 9 days before his passing, July 6th, at the age of 97. Last weekend, I was in Coarse Gold, California, to celebrate his remarkable life, remembered so fondly by 4 children, 10 grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren, and so many friends whose lives he touched. As I drove away from that rural church last weekend, I thought, I need to share some of Chuck's story with our Hometown Heroes audience. So that's what we're going to do today. I met the Lishmans over a decade ago through their involvement with a local Pearl Harbor Survivors chapter. Sadly, almost every chapter like that in the country has disbanded now, San Diego being the lone exception I know of. Our friend Stu Headley there keeps it hopping with more than a dozen survivors still on their rolls. When we started this Hometown Heroes radio program in 2007, it aired live from a local radio studio each week in tandem with the series I was producing on television. And the memories you'll hear from today come from those radio and TV interviews back in 2007. In all the years since, I've watched the Lishmans do everything they can to honor the legacy of Pearl Harbor, from pulling a large-scale model of the USS Arizona Memorial in multiple parades annually, to ringing the bell each year on December 7th in honor of the fallen, to putting up with my crazy questions at different speaking engagements that we would go to together. The Lishmans are the kind of people that make fast friendships and lasting friendships, and I think by the time we're done today, you're going to understand why. Let's start with Chuck's explanation of how a Southern California 16-year-old ended up in the Navy Reserve in 1937.
I went out to the Long Beach Airport. One of the fellows there in my class said that he had a lot of fun going out there to the airport at the Navy base there in Long Beach. And he said they fly out and they just have a lot of fun. So I thought, well, I'll join the Navy Air Force. So I went out there and signed up in Long Beach. And we used to go out and, well, we packed parachutes. And then we did some dive bombing, and we used to shoot at those sleeves, and it was a lot of fun.
What kind of dive bombers were those?
We'd go up in these little Grumman SF-1s and SF-2s, and they're the dive bombers with the wheels pulled up alongside of it. Anyway, we'd go out. Well, we'd chase the cows over the eucalyptus trees and go down to Palm Springs and get coffee and, you know, I mean, and bomb. And those old planes, we'd go up to bomb, and it'd go right up just like this, you know, and then it just about stall out, and then this is when your guts drop down like that. Come straight down to put their bomb out, you know. I mean, of course, there's nothing like it is now, you know. This is 1938-37. Mm-hmm. And release the bomb, and then when they'd pull out, you couldn't even lift your foot off of the, the plane. I don't know how many G's we were pulling, but it was gee whiz, there was a lot of them. But anyway, that's where I started, and I enjoyed it. We'd go out and shoot at sleeves. They'd tow targets, you know, behind the planes. We put black on some and green and red, and you know, so we could tell who was hitting whatever.
Yeah.
And then we'd come back in and we'd count the holes in the sleeve. Well, anyway, that's where it started, and that was fun. You know, like a kid, that was really neat. My dad was in the Merchant Marine. He was a captain on one of the tankers for Union Oil Company of California at that time. I wanted to go get a job, so anyway, he said, well, you can go out there on one of the tankers there as a mess boy or able seaman or something. You know, I was just old enough to get out there. What was I, Dorothy, 16 or 17, I guess, 17. So anyway, I did that. I went out for one summer. I went out to get on the tankers, so off I went, and we got up to Port San Luis. At the time, the crew on the Santa Maria was in there, but they were so drunk they couldn't get the ship. They loaded it there in Port San Luis. So what they did then was transfer all the crew off of the La Placentia onto the Santa Maria. And I was supposed to be going up and down the coast, you know, my first leaving home. Boy, I get lonely. So anyway, off we went to Panama through the locks down there and unloaded the coal docks and Panama City and everything. And then I've been to Antofagasta, Chile, and all that, you know, on the tankers. Well, anyway, we got back, and that was my first trip on that. But anyway, that's where I started to get on tankers. So that was more or less what I figured I would do, is be in the Merchant Marine. Well, to skip all of the other stuff, I had had an automobile accident. Some guys were drunk, ran a stop sign, hit the side of the car, and wrecked my collarbone, shoulder. So anyway, I had to let that ship go. To make a long story short, the Navy called me in. They wanted me, you know, the reserves. They were calling in reserves. You know, England was in a dire straits at that time,
right. And
they were about ready to go under. Well, I didn't go to boot camp or anything. They just took me down and put me down at North Island, and we flew down there. I had nothing to do with flying airplanes except just riding. But anyway, that's another little story. They had a bunch of dignitaries from South America and everything went on the bleachers. And they had the parachute jumps for to show them what they were doing. So they flew over the field of the parachutes. So the guys all jumped out, but one of them got his leg hooked up in the back of it and was dragging. He flew across there, and there he's dangling up there on the bottom of that plane. And they didn't know what they were going to do with him. Anyway, to make a long story short, this Lieutenant Lowry and a chief, he jumped in a plane, unauthorized, and went up and flew out over the ocean where it was quiet. And what they did was they went up there and they flew up underneath him. Now, we've watched this stuff going, you know. I mean, this is excitement like in a circus. Man, howdy. And so anyway, he took that plane, and the guy got that sucker up in the cockpit, and one guy held up, and the pilot took that plane and that propeller and cut that strap off underneath that plane. Well, that was something to remember. And nobody could remember that except I talked to one of the guys that was at the naval base the same time I was, and he remembered that incident.
Wow.
But anyway, we got him down. He had his leg all wrecked, you know, and he was in the hospital. But he lived, and that was all. But that was one of the things that would go on to impress you. But anyway, I decided I want to go to sea. That's what I was doing, you know, was going in the Merchant Marine anyway. And so anyway, why, to make a long story short there too, why, I went up and saw the admiral there of the base, and he told me there's a ship out there, and he said, yeah, well, okay. So anyway, they put me out on they said, you go on the Perry. Well, I didn't know the Perry from anything else. I looked at the carrier, and I thought, man, that's a neat ship. I want to get on that one. Got on this sucker, and I walked across four decks of those ships before I even knew I'd passed one. I said, where's the Perry? That's the first one. They're only 32 foot wide, you know. So I went back over, and that was my first chance on a Perry. Well, that's when I went up, and I said, I wanted to get married. We were going to get married in September 17th, because then I would have been 21.
That was the plan, but since he was about to ship out, there was just a small window of time in which they could possibly get married, and this is where we need a little of Dorothy's perspective.
I had my first date with Chuck when I was 13, and now my grandchildren say, Mother, did your mother let you date at 13?
What's the answer?
Well, I did it.
Whether she let you or not.
I'm not sure she always knew, but anyway, yes, we've known each other a long time.
So I went up to get permission to leave to go to get married. Well, everybody says there's no chance. Oh, Iron Mike, he's not going to give anybody any liberty or leave. So I said, well, I'm going up anyway. So I went up there, and he said, okay. He said, I'll give you 3 days, but he said, if you're not back here, you're over the hill. So I said, okay. So off I went.
They gave him 3 days, and we didn't have time to get our blood tests and get a license in California. So he borrowed a friend's car, drove the 100 miles from San Diego up to Long Beach, picked me up, and we headed for Las Vegas. We got there at midnight, stopped at a gas station, and asked the fellow where we got a license, and he called the county clerk for us. She came down this big marble steps and all, and she went ahead of us turning on the lights, made out our license for us, asked us if we wanted to be married by a minister or what, and we said we'd prefer a minister. So she said Reverend Melton is always very nice about getting up at night. So she called him, gave us his address. We went out, rang the doorbell. He came to the door, and he said, well, where are your witnesses? Well, duh. I mean, we didn't think of witnesses. So he said, well, his wife would get up. And literally he said this. The woman next door was always very nice about getting up for a couple of dollars. So that's what we gave her. But they both had on their robes, and his wife had a cold, and she stood and sniffed. And for some awful reason, I got the giggles. So Chuck said that I giggled all the way our wedding ceremony. That's what he always says. But we've often thought we should go back and tell Reverend Melton that actually the marriage did stick, because I'm sure he was questioning it that night. We got married, headed back over the back road through Yosemite, had problems with Chuck's friend's car, got back to Long Beach. He again literally dumped me out with my things in my mother's backyard, drove across town, put on his Navy uniform, beat the 100 miles back to San Diego.
Yeah, I got back to the Perry, and the guy said, I don't think he's going to make it. I said, I didn't either. They raised the gang way up there, and I was aboard, and we took the Perry, and we went off, and we escorted the Nevada and the Arizona and the Oklahoma out from Long Beach. See, it was a battleship port. And off we went to Pearl, and well, to Honolulu. And anyway, we went over there, and then my enlistment was up December 3rd of 41, and the ship was leaving for the States December 8th, and my enlistment would have been up. Yeah, I was going to the Oklahoma. My buddy was on the Oklahoma. And I had been over to the sub base and got Dorothy a red sweater and a malt mixer, a mixer. And I was up there, and I was going to go. This was Liberty, last shot, going home, you know, the next day, and everything was all fine. And man, I couldn't believe it. And anyway, that's when the Japs hit. I just had eaten breakfast and came up topside, looked out over there, and then saw these planes getting hit there on Ford Island. That's when I said, hey, here's the Japs are here. And Elmer Tune was real popular at that time. I think they were playing. And next thing I knew, boy, we were at war.
And that young man who had just gone out to buy gifts for the bride he thought he was about to be reunited with, the guy whose enlistment was technically over 4 days earlier, who was a day away from sailing home on the USS Oklahoma, he would see that battleship upside down in the harbor, not to mention the rest of that chaotic scene. He would end up in the Navy for the duration of World War II, and then spend the rest of his 97 years making sure no one ever forgot Pearl Harbor or the importance of keeping America alert. I'll never forget Chuck Lishman, and I hope by the time we're done today, you won't either. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, more memories of December 7th, 1941, aboard the destroyer USS Perry, a ship that would not make it through the end of the war. We'll hear how Chuck avoided that sinking and the other close calls that convinced him God was watching over him. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.